FM. I'm Phil Tedder. With me is Phil Conlon. How you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Suddenly, somebody jumped into my ear and I recognized him. That was me. This is the Taylor Report. You can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM, and we have a web, taylor-report.com. There's also, let me see, Facebook / The Taylor Report. And today on the program, we're going to be talking to David Hoyle, who has written a new book, a really important one, Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And it's a 610-page study, very important book, about the International Criminal Court, obviously, which has had the flattering words would be checkered history, which is to say it's been a disaster. Later in the program, we will talk to Zafar Bengash about the changing nomenclature of the villains of the Middle East. Now we have something, I think we'll call it the ISIS crisis. And I think it's the premise is that people are bored with the news, and so they always want a new name to conjure with. I think we're joined now by David Hoyle. Are you there, David?
I certainly am, Phil. How are you?
Very good, and it's great to be talking to you because you have produced a new book called Justice Denied, The Reality of International Court, and it's from the Africa Research Center, 610 pages, and it is a study, and in my opinion, brilliantly done. I'm just starting into the book, but I must say, it couldn't be more timely. Let's start off with your positions. How this International Criminal Court, after years of people talking one way or the other about whether or not there should be such a thing, really emerged rather rapidly. And if from reading some of your text, I noticed that you attribute the push to have this established to the phenomenon called the NGOs, of course, with the support of various governments. But could you talk about how it came to be?
Yes, I mean, obviously, I mean, the actual pursuit of justice in the face of wrongdoing is, you know, a absolutely sort of a cardinal aspiration, you know, and nobody can argue against that, and I certainly don't. The reality, though, unfortunately, is the attempts so far to, you know, introduce some sort of international judicial mechanism have actually been, you know, very, very flawed. And what's actually come into place ultimately, you know, seems to have been, you know, very, very political and actually, you know, politicized our tribunals. And the ICC is no exception to that. It came into being as the result of a conference in 1998 in Rome. And this, I think, is also one of the fundamental difficulties. The ICC statute, the body of laws that were actually drawn up, were drawn up in, I think, 4 or 5 weeks and offered on a take-it-or-leave-it basis.
4 or 5 weeks?
Yeah, and they were drawn up largely by NGOs or by lawyers working on behalf of NGOs. Now, you know and I know, that, I mean, certainly coming out of the Anglo-Saxon legal system, you know, a good law evolves over decades, if not centuries. You can't force, you know, law through in 3 weeks, and to this day we see those flaws, which are now actually very significant flaws in the ICC and its procedural behavior.
By the way, I want to make sure I say that the Africa Research Center has produced the book. You can access it online, the AfricaResearchCenter.com. Am I right?
.org.
Oh, .org. Yes, I get my comms and orgs mixed up. And this is really the second book along these lines. You have a book, I'm trying to remember the phrase, but comparing the court to Guantanamo.
Guantanamo Bay. Yes.
And there are similarities. It is a shock. And your book lays it out, and there's so much detail of just arbitrary decisions made by rather nameless people affecting the lives of people all over Africa, particularly, where they don't, no one involved in this thing has any recourse, but they are hauled off. By the way, let me just, for example, you have a quote, very nice, about the queen and one of the great tales where she says, "Well, verdict first and then the trial."
Alice in Wonderland, absolutely.
Yeah. But also, you could have added sentence first, verdict first, and then the trial. I mean, people have been held in prison for years without a trial.
Well, I mean, that's the, that, that's, I mean, that are those people who seek to defend the court say, well, you know, oh, well, it's, there are some startup, you know, sort of, you know, mistakes and stuff, as is in every case. The simple fact is it's a 12-year-old court. It's a billion euro plus court. It's actually more of an industry than the court. And in its 12 years of existence, they have stalled to complete their first case. The first case was one of Thomas Labanga, who was a Congolese officer who was accused of maintaining child soldiers within his forces. He has now been incarcerated. I think it will be approaching for 7 years, most of which has been actually in The Hague at the ICC. Now, you know, he's charged with allegedly having child soldiers. Now, the ICC was meant to judge the most heinous of war crimes, or the most heinous of crimes against humanity, including genocide. You know, war crimes are serious, but it's not up there with the Nuremberg charges. Yet, you know, Nuremberg was over and done with in 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
This man, Labanga, has now been in jail for 7 years. As mentioned, he's now approaching the end of the appeal process. By any count, that's not swift justice. That's a travesty of justice.
Yeah, and he could, yes, and he's helpless. I mean, you know, one could say just recently in a New York court where five young men many years ago were convicted of a terrible rape assault, and they put long years in prison. Well, they are being, you know, compensated. They're being apologized to. Their efforts are being made for reparation. Someone caught up in this system, the ICC system, who is an accused, has no chance of that.
Well, it's even worse because one of the almost unbelievable aspects of the ICC is that they have full judges within the ICC who are meant to actually decide on very, very important, very, very difficult points of law, who have never been lawyers, let alone judges. So, you know, you have the average magistrate, the average lay unpaid magistrate, part-time magistrate in Britain is better qualified than most of the lawyers. Most of the judges at the ICC.
Judges.
And, but again, actually turning to the...
Do they look good in the robes? Do they have the appropriate expression on their faces?
They have very European-type robes, you know, all flowing and you know, black and white and purple. Mm. But they aren't judges, and they aren't even lawyers. And so, coming back onto the Bangor trial, the judge, one of the judges in that trial actually was a real judge. He was actually a British judge. Mm. And on two separate occasions, he declared the trial to be at an end, to be a total mistrial. He said, you know, Mr. Labanga, please, you are to go free because I can no longer guarantee you a free and fair trial. Now, the ICC has, very strangely, a right of appeal by the prosecution. So the prosecution actually appealed this judge's very correct ruling, I have to say, on two occasions. And because it's a institutional structure, the appeal chamber actually found in favor of the prosecution because it realized that if they had found in favor of the judge and that the first key trial was overturned, you know, or stopped halfway through, that would impact so badly on the ICC. So it's all politics. It's all institutionalized, you know, bureaucracy. So it's many things, but it's not justice.
Yes. We're speaking to David Hoyle. The title of the book is Justice Denied: The Reality of the International Criminal Court, and this you can access this book at AfricaResearchCenter.org, and I really urge you to do it, to a 610-page study. There's a term you use which echoed for me. That is lawfare, which is, and I recall Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, who has some of the same concerns that you have in this book, he saying that he found that the ad hoc United Nations Tribunal for Rwanda was war by other means, which and you use it, and I notice you cite people who use this term lawfare. Give us your thoughts about that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Ramsey Clark and I'm sure come from different, you know, sides of the actual political spectrum. But I mean, we agree absolutely on this point. The only conclusion I could come to, having watched the ICC now for a number of years, is that in effect it's a instrument of European foreign policy, because it's overwhelmingly funded by the Europeans, and 2/3 or more of the funding comes actually from the European Union itself, mm-hmm. the European Union member states. Mm-hmm. And you know, as we all know, he who pays the piper calls the
that's been my experience.
Yeah, well, I have to say it's a sad reality, and so it's been used, I think, to actually, in some cases, actually threaten, and in some cases, actually cajole African politicians, African governments, to go along with, you know, Western foreign policy or European foreign policy in most instances. So, you know, and the other thing also, of course, is that, you know, one of the key things about any court is that it's you judge it on its independence. The ICC gives special prosecutorial rights of referral and deferral to the UN Security Council. And, of course, actually, yes. You know, this is the world's most political body imaginable. Mm-hmm. So you get, you know, it's, of course it's being used. And
well, by the way, you point out that it has 5 members, the Security Council. 3 of the 5 do not adhere to this court, are not members of this international.
Well, that's right. But it gets worse than that, Phil, because
but they oversee it.
Well, they can actually refer people to it, countries and people to it. It's actually worse, because what you've had in 2 cases, you've had people from Libya and people from Sudan who are not member states of the ICC being referred to the ICC by the UN Security Council, as you mentioned, 3 out of 5 members of which are themselves also not members of the ICC. So it's an incredibly perverse mechanism, which mm-hmm. has been used on several occasions. And, you know,
yes.
If you cast your mind back to 2011 and the NATO war on Libya, the ICC was actually wheeled in by the European states to actually provide, in effect, a pseudo-legal basis for that military intervention.
I recall the contribution of the marvelous, brilliant Mr. Ocampo, who had information that the Viagra was being provided to Gaddafi's troops for mass rape.
Extraordinary stuff. I mean,
and every idiot who ran a newspaper decided that belonged on a front page.
Well, and then, of course, within a matter of weeks or in some cases months afterwards, the whole story is debunked. You know, you do have journalists who actually go out. By which time, of course, there was the ICC indictment and there was a no-fly zone, and yeah. the government and country had been, you know, sort of subject to a NATO bombing campaign. So, you know, quite extraordinary. But what's interesting is that in other cases, the ICC has taken up to 3 years to decide whether it can show an interest in a country. In the Libyan case, it was within a matter of days. So they were obviously told, you know, this is a important issue for us and your funders. We'd like indictments, you know, in mm-hmm. a week rather than three years. And that's exactly what the ICC did. So it's a political instrument of lawfare.
This, by the way, this is a great book, Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court, AfricaResearchCenter.org. The author is David Hoyle. You know, I think we ought to touch on an ugly aspect of this, which you take up very eloquently, and you point out it's actually widely understood and known, but no one's doing anything about this. This is a highly racial, racist exercise. The only people being brought before the ICC are Africans.
Well, I just actually have to ask you a question, really, which is, if you had a court in Canada which said we set out to investigate and try, you know, a range of very, very serious crimes, and if that court only ever charged black Canadians with those crimes, that would be a racist court, right?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. And likewise in Britain. That is exactly what the ICC have done. Of the 36 people they have actually indicted, every single one of them has been African. So they've ignored a raft of alleged war crimes or crimes against humanity, which may or may not have been committed in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere. Totally ignored them. And the focus has been exclusively on those African countries which have come under the focus of European foreign policy.
Yes, and you point out that the European Union, which has hegemony because it's got more than 50% of the funding, they will not assist any country that does not join and to sign up for the ICC. Is that right?
Well, as you know,
which sounds like colonialism to me, somehow.
Well, I mean, the EU, the European Union, dispenses, you know, billions, hundreds of millions, or billions of dollars, or euros rather, of aid and assistance and trade and development funds every year. But one of the conditions, one of the paragraphs in all the trade agreements they sign is, unless you cooperate with or are a member of the ICC, you will not be allowed to sign those trade agreements. Now, Sudan, for example, one of the world's poorest countries, ultimately, has actually forgone, I think, maybe 800 million euros, maybe a billion euros, all in all, in European Union funding because, of course, it has chosen not to cooperate with the court, of which it's not even a member. Because of that, it's actually lost out on those funds. And that's, you know, if you are a small African country, the simple fact is, you know, you will actually sign up to the ICC for that reason alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you take up the case, a really interesting one. And incidentally, as far as I know, this is the only book where you can find some accounting of what's happened to the people who disappeared into the ICC. I'm thinking of President Mr. Gbagbo of Ivory Coast.
Yeah.
And that was one of the ugliest episodes I ever watched from a distance, with the United Nations forces actually with an armed helicopter firing at the presidential palace of the capital of Ivory Coast at the home of the president, who was involved in an electoral dispute with the opposition. And it was resolved by the French army and the so-called rebels and the UN all attacking the elected president. And he's now in prison, thank you very much.
In fact, his a court case at the ICC, if you want to use that term, court case, begins actually quite soon. No, it's actually extraordinary again because I think back in 2004, 2005, the French specifically threatened Gbagbo. So, you know, if you don't behave yourself, you will find yourself in front of the ICC.
That was part of their arsenal.
That was actually a French threat. There was no doubt about that. For whatever reason, they chose not to actually engage in that. Although the Ivory Coast did not join the ICC then, they did ask the ICC to take a look at some of the war crimes being committed in the course of a conflict actually within Ivory Coast. That was then used as a basis for ICC intervention at the behest of the French 2-3 years ago, whatever it was, when exactly you saw this incredible scene of, you know, French military units actually intervening in a country, you know, in the face of some credible evidence that the president had actually won the election he'd just been involved in. So.
Yeah. And it was a parallel was in the situation in Kenya, where apparently Britain and others didn't like the outcome of an election. The son of Jomo Kenyatta, Uhuru Kenyatta, was a winner, and they wanted to bring him. Well, he was contesting for the presidency when they hauled him in front of their court, actually acting as though maybe they could hold him there and prevent him even from participating in an election.
Well, that's right. I mean, that was the contested election, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. And there was electoral violence. There was very nasty events happening in and around that electoral violence, that election. You then had the ICC unilaterally involving itself in Kenyan affairs. It says, you know, we will be coming into this issue. And they're very, they're classically political move. It indicted three people from one side and three people from the other side.
Mm-hmm.
One of whom was actually Kenyatta, mm-hmm. who the post-election dispensation had joined the government. The interesting thing then, of course, is that you had another election 4 years later, where two of the key people involved, two of the key people who had been indicted, were elected by the Kenyan people in a very obviously a snub against the ICC. So a Kenyatta is now the president of Kenya, and his fellow co-indictee, who was on the opposite side of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
4 years ago, is now his vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all the way through that election campaign, the sort of British government and French government and the ICC, you know, are through the concept of innocent until proven guilty out mm-hmm. the window. They said, you know, we will not work with anyone who's mm-hmm. indicted. Well, you know, if you're indicted, it doesn't mean you're guilty. It means, you know, there are allegations. They said, no.
You explained several times that the judges and certainly the powerful states don't seem to understand the idea of presumption of innocence.
Well, that's the difficulty with the entire ICC, because again, it was this really strange amalgam, you know, which was actually devised by all these disparate NGOs. They don't have one particular system of law. They don't have the Anglo-Saxon system of law. They have a whole mishmash of law. So
I actually heard Judge Kama, the ICTR chief judge, saying, we have a mixture of systems.
Yeah.
And I saw lawyers looking at each other thinking, what could that possibly mean?
Well, what it means is you get flawed.
Take your chances.
Flawed law, yes, absolutely. And one of the other key flaws is this concept that, you know, you can have a double jeopardy actually for the accused. I mean, if the prosecution has the right to appeal, right, the results of the court or the court's, you know, mm-hmm. A verdict, you know, that's not good law. As far as I'm concerned,
By the way, David, isn't one of the problems here that you're talking about your writing and the book is very clear about this, but people have some duties. I know this is this is subjective, but there are people that you cite, lawyers, judges, and whatnot, who really are supposed to put their papers down and say, "I'm going to leave now, not associate myself with this."
Well, that has been one of the features of the ICC. And obviously, you know, again, there were many, many people who, you know, were idealistic, who welcomed the court's actually foundation in 2002 after the 98 conference. You know, and I think in many instances, the court initially attracted the best and the brightest. What happened, of course, in the 2, 3, 4, 5 years afterwards is that it gradually revealed itself to be a bureaucratic nightmare, and not the court that, you know, so many of these people had actually signed up too. So
yes.
they lost the best and the brightest, and they hemorrhaged, you know, really good lawyers who actually were good lawyers.
The mediocre and the grubby have moved in.
The jobs worth, you know, the grubby, the mediocre, simply the bad lawyers, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, remained. And mm-hmm. that's one more reason why this court is just, you know, it's such, I mean, to even mm-hmm. call it a court is a travesty. It's such shambles.
It's a form of decadence in a way. This is David Hoyle. The book is Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. It's at the Africa Research Center .org. What I was curious about you cite some wonderful people who probably were consulted at one point or another in their careers who do concern themselves with what appropriate courts are, and a couple of them who seem to have great credentials said it's actually a kind of a delusionary idea, the concept of international law, unless you take the greatest possible care. Can you explain
the doyen really of international law was a wonderful sort of refugee from Nazi Germany. Called George Schwarzenberg, and he was really the go-to guy on the concept of international law, based in London in the 1930s and 40s. And he said, well, you know, first of all, there is no real international law, and secondly, he said those people those lawyers who actually claim there is and seek to impose it are actually delusional. You know, they yes. are fantasists in many, many ways. And you know, this is actually one of the big difficulties, because no one, you know, objects to idealism. You know, mm-hmm. we all have our ideals, and I think many people aspire towards that, you know, sort of a shining mountain, you know, in the hinterland, which is actually the international law. The simple fact is, reality has shown that it cannot be brought into being without, you know, vast amounts of political corruption, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have the issue that, I mean, the emperor has no clothes,
mm-hmm.
but because it's this multi-million euro industry, hundreds of millions of euros and billion a euro industry, and because there are so many vested interests tied up in it, no one within a certain legal and political class wants to actually cast the first stone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the emperor is naked, but no one's going to actually tell the court that it's a shambles and shambles. Yes. And of course, also the sad thing is, you know, if it was a useless, shambolic sham court, that would be bad enough as it is. But what the court has done within Africa is, through its meddling, it's actually destroyed peace. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
David Hoyle. And it is...
pretty devastating report. I mean,
it's so well done. You have to look at it to appreciate it. And there is a second title available there, too, the International Criminal Court, Europe's Guantanamo Bay, ? And it is. Now, there are people in custody, who some of them spent 10 years before they had a trial and were acquitted. So do you give them the 10 years back? I guess, no. Why not?
Now
you can have your 10 years back if we can figure out how to do that.
Now, if I understand it, the president of Sudan is still under indictment in this court, right? And they have these floating things
that are out there, like objects in space that they put there, and at any moment can be brought into play. Suddenly, they're laying there like, or floating like mines.
And whose decision is that?
Someone in the back door. The naked emperor, who still has a mobile phone, and he says, "I want this guy indicted. I mean, I want you to move on it." And then they will. There have been people who've been visiting countries, and suddenly they're incarcerated.
So the fundamental principle that we're taught here, which is that the courts should be beyond political influence, that there's absolutely no...
The first thing they tell you is it's independent, except that it's answerable to the Security Council, which has 5 members, 3 of which don't belong to it. However, they can suggest you be indicted, but... They cannot be indicted. And Ramsey Clark, I've watched him do this several times in court, explain, if you don't have equality before the law, you don't have justice. You cannot proceed if you don't have everybody facing the same possible charges. If one guy says, no, you can't accuse me, but I'll be one of the judges for this guy here that you want to accuse. No, that's supposed to be over.